And to be completely candid, I feel like I knew something was wrong before my diagnosis. I felt this tightness around my neck and my chest. I felt some pain in some lymph nodes. I always just brushed it off. And that I was going blind in my right eye. This poor eye doctor had to tell me I was going to die of terminal cancer.
Maggie Jones, stage 4 cancer survivor and documentary maker.
The 5-year survival rate for that is less than 1%. It was 6 to 8 months with palliative conventional care. Exactly 1 year later, by 12-month scan, I was cancer-free throughout. Now, when we talk about metabolic treatments, no diet can cure cancer. These are alternative treatments. But these are the things that have been proven and published in scientific journals to say that they improve your chances of survival. They improve your... So less than a week from my diagnosis that I went on my first fast. It was 24 hours. I'd never done anything like that before, so it was a big deal for me, whereas now I'll fast for weeks. It's nothing. And I decided that, as he said, I'm never putting anything in my body that's not actively...
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. This podcast is your one-stop shop for all things health, well-being, and self-improvement. And to help me navigate and explore those amazing subjects, I tend to talk to many of the world's leading experts and people of interest. Now, so many of you have subscribed to the channel in recent weeks, which is terrific. If you've not already done so, but if you're getting value, if you're getting education and learning from some of the subjects that I've been exploring on this podcast over the last weeks, months, and 4 years now, well, then please do like, subscribe, and share with other people who you think might enjoy the content here. And do leave the podcast a positive rating, which I know you can do on iTunes and on Spotify, where at the moment I think we're at about 4.7 out of 5. It'll only take you 2 seconds, but it certainly makes all the difference my end, that it helps us present this podcast to more people with an interest in health, well-being, and self-improvement, just like yourself. Also, a reminder, we are now on Instagram and on YouTube. You can become a subscriber over there too if you want to check out the videos of these podcast episodes. And Spotify are actually allowing us to put videos of these episodes on their platform too, which is great. So no excuse not to consume the content. And as I said, if you are enjoying, do please share with other people. I think many of you will probably share this particular episode today. I am joined by a very interesting, a fascinating and incredible person by the name of Maggie Jones. She is a remarkable individual because she was given a terminal cancer diagnosis and a survival prognosis of only 6 to 8 months. And that was all of 6 years ago. Not only did she survive, but today she is absolutely thriving. And in this episode, we find out about the stress and the initial emotional impact of that diagnosis. We hear about her decision to take action as far as her own health was concerned, and the steps she took mentally and physically after her diagnosis. Expect to learn about sugar's relationship with cancer cells in the body. Maggie tells us about the unexpected long-term side effects of her treatment, which her doctors never considered would be a factor, given they never expected her to live beyond 8 months. We also talk about Maggie's experience with the ketogenic diet and why no one diet will cure cancer per se. Discover how attitude and self-perception plays a huge role in one's healing. Plus, we hear about Maggie's docuseries, which she hopes will provide guidance and inspiration to others diagnosed with cancer. You will be blown away by Maggie's story, but also by her attitude. She is a literal force of nature. I absolutely love this conversation. I got inspiration from it myself. I hope you will too. And I hope that you share this episode with other people in your life who you think might get some hope and inspiration from it too. Your story is truly remarkable. I'm sure you've heard this before, but when there's so much bad news out there at the moment, I think it's really important to be able to share a great news story, not just good news story, but a great news story with people out there to give them, well, good news, give them a lift, but also give them hope. And just to put your story into context before we go into detail, you were given a 1% chance of surviving your cancer diagnosis. And what I want to know is really, I want to go right back to the beginning of your story to when you first started to feel unwell, if we can.
That's perfect. And first, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share this, because I feel the same way. And I'll get there, but it's actually less than 1% chance of 5-year survival. I rounded to zero my chances, and that was 6 years ago in 2018. And to be completely candid, I feel like I knew something was wrong before my diagnosis. I was in the process of moving from the US to Hong Kong. There was so much going on. I was so focused in my career, everything, too busy to see a doctor. And so when I had symptoms, like I felt this tightness around my neck and my chest, I felt some pain in some lymph nodes, I always just brushed it off that, you know, I'm getting fatter, I'm getting old, whatever it is. And it wasn't until after my husband and I had moved to Hong Kong that I finally confided in him that I was going blind in my right eye. And he realized this is not a normal thing. You have to go to the doctor. And I just started my new job in Hong Kong, so I was reluctant to take time off. But I found the one ophthalmologist who was open on a Sunday in Hong Kong. And I'm so fortunate. It turned out to be the best cancer hospital in the city as well. And I went there on a Sunday, and he looked in my eye once, ordered an emergency MRI, told me to come back the next day for the results, which was a work day. So I was very nervous about missing work, but I was like, well, emergency MRI is probably important. And I came in the next day at like 8 a.m. and I waited and I waited until the very end of his shift at 7 p.m. when this poor eye doctor had to tell me I was going to die of terminal cancer. Because in that MRI, they'd seen the, at that point, it was only two brain tumors, of course, two tumors in my eye. And they were able to extrapolate at the time that it was because of my lung cancer, a primary tumor in my left lung. I had the cough. I thought it was Beijing cough. I had so many excuses. So the next, we stayed in the hospital that night, my husband and I. And the next morning, we met the oncologist. And within a week, I had the CT scan, a biopsy, and all these things that did prove that it was primary lung cancer that by then had spread to everywhere, all the lymph nodes, including my brain and my eye. And this is where, at that time in 2018, the 5-year survival rate for that is less than 1%. It was 6 to 8 months with palliative conventional care. And at that point, I was, I also have aphasia. I have to apologize to your listeners. Because of some of the conventional treatments I underwent, I have some brain damage, and so I apologize for my speaking. But I was inoperable. You couldn't extract all this disease from me. But I did have the option of radiosurgery, which I accepted to my brain, and I was very lucky that I could use a targeted chemotherapy, which I took. And so these were intended to get me maybe a year of life. And within the year of that diagnosis, or exactly 1 year later, by 12-month scans, I was cancer-free throughout. And since then, I've just struggled with the effects of my conventional treatment, things like this aphasia, some mild seizures as I work with my brain. But the reason I have these is because no one was expected to live as long as I did with my prognosis. No one has to deal with the consequences of some of these treatments. And I feel so fortunate that I do. And I'm also so fortunate that I found things like metabolic therapy that I'm sure we'll talk about that really is the reason that with my conventional treatments, I was able to find this place of healing. Now, when we talk about metabolic treatments, no diet can cure cancer. These are alternative treatments. But these are the things that have been proven and published in scientific journals to say that they improve your chances of survival. They improve your just quality of life and the impact of your traditional treatment. As I found these published, things like Dr. Thomas Seyfried's Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, so many books, so many journals out there. And by implementing those, even my palliative treatment, which was never intended to help me to survive, did. And here I am.
Well, before we come to the the approach that you took to treating your own illness. I really just want to get a sense of what your mindset was like, because you've been given this terminal diagnosis. You've 6 to 8 months to live. It's a horrifying, a terrifying place to be. What's going through your head? Because you've just moved to a new country, as you said, to Hong Kong. You have started a new job. You're away from family and friends. And then this has landed in your lap. What's going through your mind at that moment in time?
At that particular time, when I got that diagnosis, I knew what stage four cancer was. In elementary school, I'd heard a teacher saying, if you got stage four, there's no coming back. And so at that moment, I just wanted to be a good patient. And I wanted to make my husband proud and my doctor proud, and to accept my coming death as dignified as I could. And thank goodness, Matthew, that lasted about 1 week before I realized I don't necessarily need to die right now. I've come to a place in life where I'm not afraid of death, but I really love being alive. So I want to continue that. But at that time, you know, it's harder for the people around you, I think, by thinking, well, I'm going to be dead. It's going to be easy for me. But just being there for my husband, telling my family was so difficult, but I just thought it was important for them to know. Now, no parent should have to watch their child die before they do. But I had these conversations and trying to be strong for them. In a way, just talking to you now, I realized this did help with my healing in a way, because I did focus a little bit on caring for others. At the same time, my husband engaged in what he called tough love, never treating me as a patient or somebody who was dying. And it just developed this aura of health around me and my life. Even after some of my conventional treatments, I was so sick. I was laying on the couch for weeks, just vomiting, sweating, feeling so awful. But still going out to work eventually, still taking the train, giving my seat to others, and never letting myself feel like that sick person who was dying, no matter what the scans say or the research said, just enjoying the life. I was alive right now. And I said, I want to actually be alive, because so much of my past till then was ignoring my body, ignoring my symptoms, living for the future. Like, I'm going to work now so I can retire happily. And why can't I be happy now? And that's what I finally decided. Like, even if I'm just washing the dishes or doing some mundane work, it's life. It's what it is. My life isn't going to happen after cancer. It's happening right now. And that's been such a miraculous way of looking at the world, man. Ultimately, it's ridiculous. And I know it's very triggering for some people who are dealing with this kind of diagnosis now. But for me, it ended up being the best thing in the world for me, because I truly learned how to live after I was told I was going to die.
That's an amazing outlook. Having listened to you speak elsewhere, it sounds to me like cancer was a gift, really, to you.
That's really how I think of it. There's one wonderful doctor, Dr. Nisha Winters, who wrote The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. And she describes cancer as a messenger. And that's how I felt it was for me, that my poor body, these cells were just crying out for attention, for me to love them. I was spending so much time in my head at work, struggling with my career. I wasn't taking care of my body. I was drinking way too much, eating what I thought was a healthy diet, but really wasn't. Definitely not exercising enough. And so once my poor body got sick enough that it was screaming out for help, and I decided to help it, you know, and valuing my body, doing the things that it wanted for however many months that I had left, that changed everything. And my relationship with my body changed. I was willing to accept these cells and, you know that they were suffering. It was partly my fault. And then just give them the best last few months that I could. The last few months of my life, and it just got better and better and better.
So within days then of your diagnosis, your thinking had changed. You decided that you were no longer going to put any foods into your body or consume anything that wasn't healing to you. And coincidentally enough, I interviewed a cancer researcher only the other day on this podcast who specializes in the ketogenic diet. Now, I know you ascribe to this diet also. You were more so plant-based in terms of your ketogenic approach. Could you talk to me about initially your decision then to go down the route of looking at your food consumption and then taking the ketogenic approach?
Yes, what a great opportunity. So I got my diagnosis finally on that Monday. That Friday, my husband was taking me out on a little mini weekend to think about everything that was going on. And I had been reading everything I could get my hands on between work and the bus ride out to the Gold Coast in Hong Kong. And the first thing I read was just a really light book by Chris Carr, Crazy Sexy Cancer. But she does mention things like fasting and a diet change. And then over that weekend, I read Dr. Kelly Turner's Radical Remission about radical survivors of terminal cancer. And one of the number one things they all share in common is this radical diet change, including things like fasting. And I was reading through all the journals, and I came across some of these researchers you mentioned about the ketogenic diet for cancer. And I knew at that time I'd had some experience with it for weight loss. But the state of ketosis, I always emphasize, it's not a diet, it's a state. And you can get into that state of ketosis where you have more ketones in your blood than sugar through so many different diets, things like plant-based that I chose, or carnivore, or any number of things that are lower carb, no sugar, things like that. And so having compared all these different books and research I've been reading, I wanted to give myself every opportunity. So I decided I'm going with a plant-based approach because there's some ambiguous research around animal products, especially factory animal products. But I was going to keep it ketogenic so I could take advantage of these more wonderful ketones. And so, like you say, it was that Sunday, so less than a week from my diagnosis, that I went on my first fast. It was 24 hours. I'd never done anything like that before, so it was a big deal for me, whereas now I'll fast for weeks. It's nothing. And I decided that, as you said, I'm never putting anything in my body that's not actively healing. If I couldn't find a study for it then, where it showed that it improved my immune system, if it killed cancer cells in a petri dish, if it reduced my inflammation, there's no reason I needed to put it in my body. So that's when I had to give up my affection for alcohol and a lot of other types of foods, but to fill my body with these wonderful leafy greens, cruciferous vegetable bowls. I still ate, especially on the weekends, some pasture-based eggs, some wild-caught salmon. When I talk about plant-based, I use the more technical definition of 5 to 10% of my calories from animal food. But again, never any animal products that are raised in a factory. Like, these are wild-caught, free-range. And once I came back to America, when my cancer was completely no evidence of disease, it's gone, I'm cancer-free, I began to mix up that I'm not as strict about the ketogenic side or, you know, the plant-based side. I'm incredibly strict. I will never eat anything processed with sugar, any fake foods. But just my goal now is metabolic flexibility. My healthy cells have this incredible ability to use so many different types of fuel, carbs, protein, fat, whereas cancer cells don't have that same flexibility, and I'm going to take advantage of that as much as I can, just filling myself with all the healthy foods that are out there.
I love that term, metabolic flexibility. I've never heard that before. That's a terrific term. It's important to say as well, you're not necessarily pressuring people or suggesting people ascribe to this ketogenic diet per se. This worked for you. It may not necessarily work for somebody else. Somebody else might need to take a different approach. But it's important to also to recognize that through something like the ketogenic diet, we're no longer consuming processed sugar. And what I think is fascinating, and I've heard you speak about this before, is that the PET scan, which is used to scan for cancer cells in the body, in order for that to work properly, you need to inject, I think it is, a radioactive glucose into the body such that then this cancer shows up, because the glucose goes straight to the cancer cells because they just love glucose. They love sugar.
Exactly. And so I can't emphasize enough how right you are that this is not a treatment that I'm trying to say anybody should use. Everybody's cancer journey is so specific to them. And diet especially is specific, not just to your personal thoughts, but your genetics, epigenetics, type of cancer, and all of that. You're necessary to work with a nutritionist or your medical team. But any cancer that is able to be seen in a PET scan, those are the ones that are going to be susceptible to a ketogenic diet, because those are the ones that are sucking up all the glucose as seen in the scan. And so that's usually about up to 90% of cancers. And it's especially the late stage cancers where it's very clear that they are susceptible to a ketogenic diet that removes one of their favorite fuels, the glucose in your system. And of course, cancer doesn't only run on glucose. There are other amino acids like glutamine. No diet, again, is a cure for cancer. But these are just things that can improve your outcome and improve your quality of life.
What I wasn't aware of until researching for this interview today was that fewer than 10% of cancer cases come about as a result of a genetically inherited change, which means that 90% of cancers are coming about as a result of nurture. In other words, our interaction with our environments, our diets, stress, etc.
Now, I'm definitely not a doctor or researcher myself, but I do consider myself a reporter. My background was in journalism. My husband and I are working on a award-winning docuseries, Cancer Revolution, featuring many of these doctors that we've been talking about. And the one thing that we always ask all of these doctors, as conventional to integrative as we can, is there any gene that is 100% penetrative to give you cancer? And the answer is no. There is no gene that you can get that will 100% give you cancer. And at the same time, your healthy cells can have these genes, these oncogenes that we associate with cancer. And it really does then come down to the environment, the epigenetic tumor environment. Is it going to be welcoming to cancer? And that, to me, it was amazing to know that this is not in my destiny. This is not in my DNA saying I have to have cancer. This is within my control. And I'm not saying that anybody is responsible for their own cancer. Absolutely not. No one deserves cancer. But just that you are not a victim of your DNA and that there are changes that we can make. You look at things like the BRCA gene that became so popular with Angelina Jolie having to take out, preventative mastectomies. This used to cause cancer in about 40% of cancer cases. Now it causes cancer in over 70%. And this is just a change in the last 100 years. And something has changed in our environment to make this the case. And we look at how many younger people, I was 40 when I was diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer, and it's happening more and more. But at the same time, the other thing that we're seeing happening more and more is cases of healing like mine. Like my story is so not unique. And my husband and I go about and we collect them for our documentary project. And there are hundreds of people with just as dire prognoses who are living happily, wonderful lives, sometimes still with cancer, sometimes without. But the fact is, in my head, we all have a little bit of cancer inside us. I let mine get out of control for sure. I wasn't taking care of myself. And even though it doesn't show up in the scan now, there's a possibility there's still a little bit of cancer inside me that's not detectable. But this doesn't affect my life. I'm not scared of dying of cancer. I'm not scared of dying of cancer anymore at all. But just knowing that it's out there is something my body lives with and I will always live with.
I would like to ask you this. How much do you think your attitude to your illness contributed to your recovery? The reason why I ask is because I recently spoke with a Harvard psychologist, Professor Ellen Langer, who is famous for being the mother of mindfulness. And she has been promoting this idea that your perception of yourself is hugely significant, especially when it comes to something like illness. And I'm just interested to know, because you strike me now as somebody who's full of life, of vitality, but somebody who is brimming with optimism. So how much do you think that factored into your recovery?
That is such an insightful question. And it did. And there are two different ways I think that it did. The first is early on, before I started my mindfulness practice or anything like that, I had an attitude where I thought I could do anything. And it's not necessarily a very good personality trait. But after that first week of grieving my life, I truly started to believe that if anybody can survive this, it can be me. And I think that faith in myself and in looking at my doctors and knowing that I knew my body even more than they did, still taking advantage of their incredible wisdom and experience and all that, but not letting them tell me when I'm going to die because they don't know me, that helped a lot. And the second way is I am a massive believer in the placebo effect. And this is something that's been studied that we just can't even question, that your mindset has something to do with how your body is going to react. And it's so funny because things like the ketogenic diet, mindfulness, all of these practices, modalities that I consider helped with my cancer healing have been studied. There's a lot of research out there, but they haven't been studied quite as largely as some other cancer treatments. So I'll talk to my oncologist now about some of the things that I do. And he'll just, you know, shake his head and be like, oh, that's just placebo. And I'm like, what does it matter if I'm living 5 years after you told me I was going to die? What does it matter if if it works, let me continue to believe this thing that is keeping me alive, giving me such great quality of life. To me, it all comes down to just, yes, that mindset is so critical. And then trusting yourself and trusting that mindset, even in the face of the naysayers who think they know more because of the white coat. And I'm not against doctors. No one goes into medicine because they don't want to help other people. But I still believe I know myself better than anyone.
You have read lots of books, as you said already. I'm just curious as to whether you have read Dr. Jeff Rediger's book, Cured, in which he details lots of remissions and lots of what would be deemed to be miraculous recoveries. And a lot of them come about as a result, again, of optimism and of attitude. And I have to highly recommend that book. It's a fascinating read. But he does say that the number of amazing recoveries that exist out there haven't been documented simply because they haven't attracted the attention that they deserve.
This is so true. And in my case, I think I've become known because I just talk so much and make so much attention. But while I'm trying to find these other survivors to document their story for our YouTube channel, I do find that some people don't want to talk about it either. It's part of their life they want to leave behind, or it's something they never shared with their family before. And so there are, even as many survivors like me that you'll see out there, there are, I don't know, tenfold more who haven't shared their story. And for anybody who is suffering through this diagnosis right now, I know how hard it is to find that positive outlook and to ever believe that this could be for any good cause. But if anything else, I do believe those people can be a success story and an inspiration for others who are struggling. And that's something that really helped me early on, is like, maybe I can give hope to someone else. Actually, I had some cousins who were diagnosed shortly after me, and I thought, oh, great that I've been able to walk this road before they did. And even now with my brain radiation necrosis, it's becoming more and more well known as people live longer and longer with these treatments. And I'm so grateful that I can be a pioneer in healing now necrosis. Just because you're the first to talk about it doesn't mean you're the first. And it definitely doesn't mean you're going to be the last.
Okay, so you were given your terminal diagnosis, you had less than 1% chance of surviving this cancer, which was coursing through your body. At the time, you were grieving for the first few days after the diagnosis. Then you thought, no, I'm going to take control of this and at least take control of what I'm consuming and how I'm living my life from here on. I'm going to be a good patient, as you said, because you wanted to be a good patient for your doctor, but also for your husband. And all the while, you're still getting conventional treatments of radiotherapy and chemotherapy. Your prognosis was 6 to 8 months. At what point in that time do things start to improve for you? And do you start to think to yourself, hold on a second, I'm not getting any sicker. I'm actually getting better. At what point did that happen?
That's such a good question. When I was diagnosed, I was still very attached to allopathic medicine, and I did believe everything doctors told me. So I had this, you know, less than a year in my head, deeply ingrained, even as I became healthier and and so it was that first month I'd had my first radiation in my brain. I'd started some chemotherapy and I was so sick. I definitely felt like I was dying, but I felt that hope. Like I said, and I'd read stories that a couple people had made it. And again, I thought, if anybody can make it, I can make it. And so that seed had been planted, but I was still expecting death. And over the next, you know, 2 months, so we're talking 3 months after my diagnosis, I'd actually lost over 50 pounds, which was necessary. I was very overweight before. and I was feeling my body for the first time. I had taken up these mindfulness practices and understanding the relationship between my mind and my body, feeling healthy. I was walking every day, at lunch, at work. And that's when I really thought, I feel healthier than I ever have in my entire life. But I still thought, oh, it's going to be sad when I die in a couple of months. And then I went to the Mayo Clinic in the U.S. to get a second opinion for my next scans. And by then, my two first brain tumors had resolved, but I had two new brain tumors that had come up. My eye tumors had resolved, but there were a couple other things. So it was a mixed bag. It looked like I was doing better, but there were still some things new. And so I went back. I did another round of radiosurgery for my brain. I started a new chemotherapy, and I was still feeling better than I felt the first time. And so I guess to answer your question, it was probably around 6 months. I started my blog. I was sharing some of this research. And I was still thinking, well, I'm going to be dying soon. I wasn't taking care of my teeth. There's a lot of stuff I wasn't doing because I wasn't expecting a future. But I just couldn't see this beautiful, healthy body dying right away. And so then there is a little bit of a, you know, confusion in my mind. But definitely once 1 year passed and I had that 1 year scan and everything was gone, I had a little cry outside the hospital. And I realized that, you know, cancer will always be with me, as I think it is with everybody. But, and there's never going to be an after cancer. I can never go back to my old life. That's the life that gave me cancer. So that old Maggie is dead. But there's something new. There's this new life now that I'm so excited to try. And I will say that realization was at 1 year when I saw in the scans that now my destiny truly is up to me.
And what was the conversation like between yourself and the doctors after that 1 year when they had, as I said previously, given you 1% chance of survival? And then here we are 12 months later and you've got a good bill of health. What was that conversation like? Because they must have been as flabbergasted as you were.
So the main hospital where I went to, my main oncologist who diagnosed me, it's very Hong Kong style, a little bit in the Far East, just not to share a prognosis or share too much information with the patient. So that's what started a lot of my research, is he never told me the 6 to 8 weeks. I had to go onto Google. I had to see that, oh, the median survival rate for lung cancer spread to the brain is 6 to 8 months, I should say. And so we weren't super open about that. It really felt in Hong Kong that we're all just ignoring what we all knew. They were weighing me every time I went every month. And of course, I was dropping a ton of weight because of my new diet. And they never said anything. They just assumed, oh, it's cachexia. She's dying. It's fine. And it wasn't until that last scan, I don't think she believed it was permanent. I think that doctor thought it was just a nice little reprieve. It was going to come back immediately. But he was grateful for the chance to have some good news for me. There's another hospital, the public hospital I was also going to there just to double up my chances. And that doctor actually asked for a copy of my scans to hang in the back to give hope to his doctors who are treating other people. Yeah, that meant a lot to me. And so my first doctor at the Westernized Hospital, we have some disagreements because he's also the one who first found my necrosis and thought it was another brain tumor. And this is very common. You can't differentiate a cancer of the brain from necrosis through an MRI. But by then I'd had 3 or 4 brain tumors and I knew this wasn't a tumor. And he didn't believe me. He wanted to irradiate again, which would have killed me. And so I went and I paid out of pocket for a neurosurgeon to give me the special scan that will at least tell you it's more likely to be necrosis. And it did. And his excuse then was, well, I normally work with a larger team. I'm like, gosh, we fought so hard over this for a month and you wanted to give me more radiation that would kill me. And no apology. And so that's when I left and I moved to the UK.
How much do you think your intuition played in all of this? Because it seems to have reared its head a couple of times.
That's a great question. I never was in touch with my intuition. I'm still working on it. I was so analytical and in the past, but I did begin these mindfulness practices, just beginning with MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, because I found the journals that say it can help cancer. I took some classes in yoga, in meditation. And these are things I'd done in my early youth that I was finally coming back to, but still with a very analytical Western mindset. But over time, as people who meditate a lot do, you have some experiences, you understand the connections with your body. And I feel like I'm finally beginning to develop a little bit of intuition. But at the time, I'm not sure if I wasn't in touch with it then. So I really think it was more my hubris and arrogance that helped me out the most. And just believing I knew better.
Hubris can come in handy, clearly, at times. Let's talk about your docuseries. What motivated it and what is it about? And where can people get access to it?
Wonderful. Well, number one, it's not about me. So you're lucky there. It's about the science. So we pulled together some of the most amazing doctors and researchers at the forefront of metabolic therapy. Just people whose books I'd read, whose research I'd read, Thomas Seyfried, Walter Longo, who's been on the show, Nisha Winters, who I've mentioned, dozens of others. And they're there to explain the science. And what is most fascinating to me is things like a ketogenic diet for cancer have been explored and known for over 100 years, this metabolic therapy. But we just lost it when the genetic paradigm reared its head in the 50s. And I think genetic research is so important, things like sickle cell anemia, which may be cured. Like, there's so much you can do with that. But it's becoming evident, and even many doctors know, that cancer is not the genetic disease that we've been taught it was. The fact that no gene of the 100% penchant to cause cancer, that your healthy genes can't, or healthy cells can still have cancerous genes. There's a wonderful experiment that was done in the 80s and then repeated over and over, where we could take a cancer cell with a cancerous nucleus and put that nucleus into a healthy cell, and that healthy cell remains healthy. It never gets cancer, but even with that cancerous DNA. But at the same time, if you take this cancerous cytoplasm with your mitochondria, and you put that into a healthy cell, that cell becomes cancerous. And that's just one of many sources of evidence on why cancer is not in the gene. It's in the mitochondria. It's in the environment for that tumor. So we're talking to all the scientists. It doesn't sound like it's going to be interesting. It's about mitochondrial function leading to the cancer, but it's actually fascinating. Especially episode one, which is out now. You can find it at cancerrevolution.film, one R. This talks about that early scientist, Otto Warburg, who developed this 100 years ago and how he fought for it, but all of these social factors that really prevented us from knowing about it. And this is important to me because the question I get the most from people who approach me about their cancer is, if this metabolic therapy works, why hasn't my doctor heard about it? And we explore that in episode one, where we learn, like, the doctor who developed it was kind of a jerk. Nobody wanted to know about this. He was a Jewish gay man who stayed in Nazi Germany. And so there's a lot of contention around what that means. And then, of course, the development of the structure of DNA and beginning to understand the genetic promise, it all fell by the wayside. And then we talk in the continuing episodes about the doctor who kept us alive in the 80s, Pete Peterson from Johns Hopkins, and our wonderful Thomas Seyfried, who is still researching now every day and what he's done. And finally, some of the therapies that are out there that you could talk to your doctor now and find research, bring to your doctor to hopefully get them on board with using some of these integrative therapies. Doesn't have to be your alternative, people you're with or without conventional treatments, to really see an improvement in your outcome.
I'm actually going to be talking to Thomas Seyfried on the podcast in a couple of weeks' time. So I'm looking forward to having a chat with him then. So if people want to find that documentary, then can you remind people where they can go?
Yes, it's at Cancer Revolution. There's one R, so it's like cancerevolution.film. And you can purchase episode one there for just a donation as small as $1. This goes to, well, first pay for the bandwidth, but also we are a nonprofit. It's just my husband and me making these documentaries. But it's not something you'd see on YouTube. It's actually a very quality documentary. We've won over 80 awards that you can review on IMDb right now. It's fantastic. And we've had three universities already say they're going to be using these shows in their curriculum. And we're talking with TBS. So it takes a little while for two people to do this from donations. But we're hoping that it'll be even more widely available in the near future, a couple of years.
amazing and so informative, as is your website, which has so much information and so much knowledge and value in there. Lots of links to research as well, latest research. But I think that probably the best part of your website is at the top of the homepage, and it reads, "Just diagnosed, start here."
Gosh, and I'm so ashamed. I have not been putting enough time into the website now. I'm going to do it right after this, as I've been focusing on the docuseries. But yes, so this started out as just a collection of the research that I was coming across from my friends and family to let them know I'm not crazy for doing this. This is science. And then I met more and more people who are interested. And yeah, it blew up a lot, especially for people who are interested in the plant-based approach. This is definitely not appropriate for everybody. This is something that you need to talk to your doctor or nutritionist about. But for people who already have that decision, it can be difficult to be ketogenic and plant-based, but definitely not impossible. So I share some recipes, some meal plans, things like that up there. But like you say, the main reason for it, I think, is just share that research and let people know that this is real.
What do you want people to take away from this conversation? And what do you want people to take away from your website and the docuseries about their own health?
You are your own advocate. You are in control. And if it's not your fault, if you're sick, absolutely not. But it's in your control. DNA is not your destiny. Don't let that just color your ability to heal. Don't let somebody else take control over what's in your body. And even everybody is going to die. And this isn't a sad thing, but we have control over how we're going to do it, how we're going to feel about it. Like I said, I don't fear death anymore, but I love life so much. So let's just live life right now while we have it. And that's all we can ask, really. I can be hit by a car tomorrow. I almost was. I try not to do that anymore. I can be hit by a meteor tomorrow. But as long as I'm living the life I want this very moment, that's all I can ask.
Well, finally, my last question for you is, and it's the big question, I suppose, the question that listeners and viewers will be wanting to know, how is your health today? Because judging by certainly your mood, it seems to be thriving. So do tell us, what is your situation health-wise at the moment?
I'm still cancer-free. My brain is a disaster. Actually, it was last year my neuro-oncologist told me if he showed my brain scans with my radiation necrosis to 10 different doctors, all 10 would think I was a vegetable. And this was right after I came back from a solo trip to Bali to get my yoga teacher training. I'm definitely not a vegetable. And to me, it's just evidence, again, that what you see in your scans and what people in white coats tell you is not the whole story. Only I know the whole story of my health. And so I don't give much credence to my scans anymore. I pay attention to how I feel. And I feel just amazing.
Well, you look fantastic as well for people who can't see you. You're an absolute inspiration. I love your story. It's such a great news story. What I will do is I'll pop a link to all of those websites and your docuseries, etc., in the show notes for this episode. But Maggie Smith, thank you so much for joining me today. Loved talking to you.
Thank you again for this opportunity. Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you for listening or watching this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you enjoyed it, or indeed any of the previous episodes, and you've not already done so, please like, subscribe on whatever platform you're consuming this content, and do leave the podcast a positive rating, because it does help push this podcast into other people's ears and eyes, people just like yourself who value the subjects of health, well-being, and self-improvement. Until next time, stay happy.